Hello, and welcome to Living on Purpose. I have a guest in studio here in the first half hour, and her name is Lynn Burnfield. She is the host of The Lynn Show here on Radio Ear Network, and we're going to find out what's going on with her. Let's start with one of the tracks from a CD that she put together. It's called I Won't Go With a Whimper, and I believe this is the song she usually closes with. So we're going to open Living on Purpose with this one, and we'll be right back to tell you more about what's happening today.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Always in my face and figure I've both seen better days. Sight, no, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boom.
Friday, April 11th, 2008, and we're here live in the studio at Sarasota, Florida, and my name is Lynn Thompson, the host of Living on Purpose, and we are just launching into this first half hour. If you'd like to be in touch, please feel free, livingonpurposelynn@gmail.com. And so what we just heard was I Won't Go With a Whimper by my guest, Lynn Burnfield. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
Oh, dear. There's going to be an echo in here, I can tell. And how are you today?
I'm good. I'm very good.
And you're not used to doing your show live, you said?
No. No, I don't do my show live. My show is all recorded in my bedroom.
In where the acoustics are good, right?
Exactly.
Tell us when your show is heard on Radio Ear Network.
Tuesday, 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, mm-hmm. and Monday, 3 a.m.
For the European listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's great. And what do you talk about on your show?
I'm a psychotherapist. I wrote a book called When You Can, You Will. And it's all about why people can't make the changes in their life that they might want to make when they want to make them. Mm-hmm. So I talk about what gets between people and the changes they want to make in their life. And because I'm also a musician, as you were mm-hmm. playing my CD, I play my CD. You can hear that song on my show. And I have a number of friends who have created independent CDs, you know, that aren't signed to record labels and you can't get them in the music stores. So I play them.
Great.
And I've started interviewing artists about what it's like to be an artist in this culture.
Mm-hmm.
Not an easy thing. When I was living in Los Angeles, my entire private practice was writers and artists. So I know a lot, not only from my own life, but from theirs about the struggle.
You do wear a lot of different hats. I didn't know that you were a musician until you handed me your book the other day, which is called When You Can, You Will.
Yeah.
It's a great book, and I've only had so much time to be able to look at it with the schedule that Joey handed me when I arrived on Sunday. It's been a bit of a blur, mm-hmm. but what I have read, I want to read more. I mean, this was quite a few years ago that you read this, wrote this, and I'm reading it now, in the 90s.
Yeah. When You Can, You Will is the correct title for this book in a number of ways. I wrote the first version of this book in 1984. And couldn't get anybody to do anything with it.
Okay.
Actually, I called it something else then, too. And then in 1990, I realized that the appropriate title for this book was When You Can, You Will. And I approached the only agent who had been interested in it at that time. It took a lot of rewriting, a lot of different proposals. And then when I finally had a proposal that she felt comfortable running, she told me that most of the editors and publishers that she approached said it was a dangerous book.
Oh, a dangerous book.
Yes, it was against the conventional wisdom. So it took us a long time to find a publisher. The danger, as I understand it, is that we're really a goal-oriented society. We're not interested in process here. So the emphasis is all on what you're going to do, mm-hmm. not why you might not be able to do it or how you can do it, just that you should do it. If you read the beginning of the book, I talk a lot about it being the Nike culture. That Nike made a lot of money telling us that we could just do it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's not true. Everybody knows it's not true.
Well, it's like with affirmations. If you're saying something to yourself in the mirror that you don't believe, no surprises that it's not going to be effective. And I remember this idea from a while ago that it's more effective if you make it realistic. Like if you say, until now, this has been true. And you're nodding, so you mm-hmm. can totally relate to that. And now, this is something that I can envision, so that mentally you can accept that there is a line, you know, like when I turned 50, until now all of this has happened, and now a lot of other things are possible, and so your mind can sort of open and say, well, okay.
Absolutely, that's true. And I think the underlying point that you're making
mm-hmm.
is that we have the idea in this culture that there's a right way and a wrong way, there's the healthy person and the unhealthy person, there's the correct and the incorrect. In fact, I don't believe there's a one-size-fits-all anything.
Mm-hmm.
And we get caught because we think, oh, if I'm not like this, then there's something wrong with me. If I can't do this, if I don't look like this, if I don't think this or feel this, clients are always saying to me, is this normal? As if there's something.
Some sort of universal benchmark, right?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And so as long as you think that there's something you have to do or be or think or feel, then you can't be honest. You're forced to say things to yourself that you don't believe. It's knowing that there's nothing wrong with you, that you can't be anything that the rest of us aren't. You're a human being and the rest of us are human beings. So if you're scared or sad or you can't lose weight or change your job or clean your room or whatever it is, you're not inadequate or weak or lazy or crazy. There's some good reason.
And you're always in the sort of the perfect place at the perfect time, even if it doesn't feel that way. If you can tell yourself that, or when you tell yourself that, then at least there's sort of a calmness and you can think, okay, this is all part of a process. Nothing is sort of fixed and then stays static. Everything is changing anyway. I think the word should is a trigger, isn't it?
Yes,
like
it is.
Some of those things that you just said are things that we think we should do. Mm-hmm. And again, that's with reference what we assume to be other people's expectations of us or the way that it should be in some ultimate way.
Oh, I think that's right. And I think it's epidemic. We're unwilling, unable, not unwilling. I think we're quite willing, but we're unable to accept ourselves if we somehow differ from whatever it is we've decided we're supposed to be. That's the danger. it's what you were saying earlier about the affirmation. You can't change if you're trying to be something you can't be.
Mm-hmm.
From the therapist's point of view, at least this therapist's point of view, we have our conscious mind, and our conscious mind is giving us all this nonsense about what we have to do and ought to be and what everybody else wants and that. Our unconscious mind is monitoring what we can do, what is safe for us to do. And it will stop us if it's not safe. And then when we can't do the thing, we start yelling at ourselves, not knowing we have been stopped by ourselves for a really good reason, because it's not yet safe.
And you have an example in your book here of a woman who was married and happy in her marriage, but wasn't sure why she was holding back and feeling afraid in her sexuality with her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because of a earlier childhood memory that because she didn't want to be the whiny little girl to her parents, she found a way to adapt and modify her reaction from an encounter with a slightly older boy when she was little. And so that was surfacing again in her unconscious and shutting her down in a marriage where hopefully you are in a place where you feel safe and nurtured.
Yeah, that's right. And it's knowing that this thing you can't do, whatever it is, there's a reason you can't do it. It's not that you're neurotic or you're pathological or you're crazy or you're inadequate. And that if you can discover the reason, then you have the possibility of addressing that reason and being able to do the thing. But as long as you keep saying, but I should be able to, I should be able to, I should be able to, you're not going to find the reason, you're not going to be able to address it, and you won't be able to do the thing.
So it's kind of funny, because when you say you should be able to, you think there's a willingness, but really it's just butting up against that closed door. So until you can make that leap from the unconscious to the conscious and then recognize it and start to work with that in the conscious realm. Okay, so how do you do that? How do you make that leap?
Well, it depends on how serious the danger to you is. In the example you gave, this person would have had a lot of feelings, a lot of unexpressed feelings that would have been unpleasant,
right,
and scary. In something like that, you probably want to do that in a therapeutic situation where somebody can help you surface those feelings and experience those feelings where it's safe.
Yeah, because you're feeling those, you say this in your book, When You Can, You Will, as well. The name of your book is When You Can, You Will. It just sort of slides into the sentence that you experience those things just like you did then. It's those flashes of anxiety and that clench in the stomach, right, that you just go, wow, have I grown anywhere since that moment? And what is this about? And you can sort of think of maybe general reasons why, but it's the specifics, isn't it? Specific to you.
Yeah, it is. And you really did read it.
I managed to do
yeah,
a bit.
Yeah.
It's my speed read.
Yes. Oh my God. I'm so impressed.
Thank you.
The other thing that's actually not in the book, because I didn't know it when I wrote the book,
mm-hmm.
was the contribution of brain chemistry to what's going on. That when we have these experiences, our brain learns that this experience triggers this response. And so whenever later in life we have this experience, that old response is triggered. So in this case, any kind of sexual activity would trigger all that old, oh my God, this is terrible stuff. And it would all be going on reflexively, right? Chemicals are dropped into the bloodstream and responses feel like it was happening then. So if it happened to you at 2 or 4 or 8 or 10, you're feeling 2 or 4 or 8 or 10. You're not feeling like a grown-up.
It's a body memory.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the scarier the experience was, the more you probably want to do this in the context of therapy. But I don't know whether you got to the example of the woman who wanted to go back to work and couldn't make herself go back to work. She had worked before she was married, and now her children were mm-hmm. in college, and she liked working, and she wanted to have an additional identity beside mommy.
Yeah.
Husband was supporting her. Everything was go. Couldn't make herself, couldn't remember where her resume was, forgot to get the newspaper.
You're referring to this. I did read that about there's reasons why yeah. we're late for a meeting and why we forget the time of the appointment. And yeah.
So the work with her was she discovered, although she was not consciously thinking about it, that, I don't know, she was married 25, 28 years. Many of their friends had begun to divorce. And she thought, you know, my husband has had a stay-at-home wife all this time. Mm-hmm. And how's he going to feel if I'm not there at dinner time? And what if he wants to go on vacation and I can't get it off? And so unconsciously, she was thinking, however much I want to go to work, maybe work will endanger my marriage. That is not a price I am willing to pay. So until she knew that, all she was doing was yelling at herself about how she couldn't, you know, make herself get the job. Right.
Yeah.
But once she knew what the problem was, she solved it in what I consider to be the most elegant solution I've ever heard. She went to work for her husband.
Oh, great.
Right.
Make it a team.
Right. The thing is that if it's something like that, that once you know what the reason is, you can solve it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you don't have to, you know, it's not a therapeutic issue. You don't know, you're not surfacing deep unconscious memories. But still, you have to know what the thing was that was stopping you before you can address it. And again, because this culture is so damn results oriented, we're not looking at what's stopping us. Okay, I've made that point.
There's sort of a combination of tuning in to what those subconscious influences are with what is important to us right now in this moment. And I think you were kind of addressing both of those right there.
Yeah. But again, for me, over and over again, it's that we have this idea of what is correct or normal or healthy or good, and that if we're not doing that, that we are somehow flawed or bad. And that idea causes not only so much pain, but the inability to look to see why we're not doing that.
I've got a question for you.
Uh-huh.
Why do we have to change?
Oh, we don't.
Okay, so it's all right. There could be some people who feel resolved and all the subconscious is conscious and they're just exactly where they want to be in their lives and no worries, no shadows. So we could just cruise along as we are. Like, not everybody has to change. You're talking about the people who are feeling like there's something they think they want to do and should do and all that kind of thing, but aren't able to for some reason. Those are the people you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up.
Okay, good.
There are a number of things about this. First of all, you know, I'm a therapist, so the people who came to me because it was something
you know. Yeah, you don't talk to the other ones.
Exactly, right. You know, you don't come to see a therapist because everything is cruising along, you know. That, right?
Well, sometimes it's nice, though, because then you get flying colors. It's nice to have that feedback.
Yeah, but mostly people don't do
mostly
that.
Mostly people don't.
You're
okay.
Right. So I wrote this and talk about this for people who really believe that their life will be enhanced by a change they can't make. Okay? So
right.
That's first of all.
Okay.
Second of all, sometimes just trying harder will do it. You know, I don't mean to say that people should not keep trying. They should keep trying because if it works, hooray, and you don't have to do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another piece, and I talk about it ongoingly, I think, in the book, and that is sometimes you will find that the thing that's stopping you, the thing that you would have to confront in order to make whatever this change is too scary, too unpleasant, too endangering. And in those cases, I think people should simply go to the movies. They should say to themselves, I would like to be this or do this or have this, but the cost is too great. And I can see that the cost is too great, so I'm going to stop trying that. I'm just going to make peace with the fact that this is what I can do with my life now, and I'm going to go out and have as good a time as I can have. For two reasons. One, because the cost is too great. Mm-hmm. And two, because the happier you are, the easier it is to do the hard things. Did I make that clear?
Yeah, the happier you are, the easier it is to do the hard things. And you're happy because...
because you are not beating yourself up over what you're not being able to do.
You're more... yeah, there's not so much resistance.
That's right.
Yeah. I had a question.
Yeah, this happens to me all the time.
Mm-hmm. When people are in a particular identity, in a particular role and job, and you ask them, if you could do anything else, what would you do? I wonder if it's the people who have themselves sort of pigeonholed and can't imagine making the leap into any other reality for themselves to really reinvent themselves, as it were, or have a whole new identity. I wonder if those people are holding on to some kind of rigid perception of themselves and keeping themselves safe. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Do you think?
I do. And what this makes me think of, all the early chapters in the book are about the family and what we learned in the family and how we modeled people in the family. In fact, that's where I am in my show.
Oh, you're at that stage.
Yeah, the next two shows are on modeling and anti-modeling. Mm-hmm. And I talk about the fact that if you modeled a parent, well, I mean, you have to model a parent. You haven't got much choice. When you're a kid, the only versions of what's possible to be are your parents. So you model them. If later in life, the thing that you modeled, whatever it is you're doing, doesn't feel good, then it's not just a question of you want to change this because it doesn't feel good. It becomes a question of being different than the parent that you modeled. And while this is a hard concept for people to believe, it can feel like a betrayal of the parent. Even if the parent is dead, even if you have come not to like the parent over time, doing it differently than that parent can feel like a betrayal. And that in itself can stop us. Mm-hmm. And because that's a concept that most people don't want to accept, they also don't realize that that's what's getting in their way. And that can continue to keep people in that pigeonhole you were talking about. Even when a different life would fit them and a different life would feel good. And again, in order to do that, you'd have to make some peace with the fact that you are now leaving that parent behind.
I think that's a really excellent point, and it brings a few things to mind. One, a personal example of realizing about 8 years ago when I was making a transition from being a self-employed photographer to realizing I really wanted to make use of some of my other skills. And my father suggested that delivering mail might suit me. And it was a very revelational time because I realized that I had been resisting his suggestions my whole life. When I was always pummeled with the question, what do you want to do with your life when I was younger? I could always think of all the things I didn't want to do, but not what I wanted to do. And when he said that, I realized that he could be right. And I realized that I'd been rebelling for a long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was a huge shift for me to open that and embrace that. And it's true. I love delivering mail. I've been doing it for over 5 years.
It's great. Mm-hmm. It's great. I had a client who had that exact same experience. It was a kind of store that her mother had. And because she didn't like her mother so much, she didn't, until she was 40, I think, consider the possibility of doing this thing, which was perfect for her. Yeah. And I have a personal story about that as well.
Okay.
A little bit different. I had a conversation with my mother. This is really bizarre, I think. She said, do you remember that there were these people who lived on our block who moved into bigger house? I said, okay, Mom. And she said, and these people who lived on our block and they moved into a bigger house? I said, okay, Mom. And she said, did you remember that both of them had children die? I said, God, no, I didn't remember that. And she said, your father always wanted to move into a bigger house. And I always resisted it.
Whoa.
And I never told him why.
Wow.
Okay, so fast forward. My ex-husband and I are buying a second home in Sarasota, Florida. The only person I didn't tell was my mother. And I had this terrible dream in which I was on a yacht. Somebody came to me on the yacht in the middle of the water and said, this yacht is on fire and we have to swim to shore. And I said, oh, I can't. My parents are on the ship. I can't abandon them. I can't leave my parents on a burning ship. We did, in fact, buy the house. My mother was in a freak automobile accident. And my husband said to me, she'll stop at nothing.
Oh, whoa.
The point is that in order to do that, I had to let go of any attachment, any modeling that I had with my mother. And it wasn't easy. There was a whole lot of psychic stuff attached to it.
Yeah. Okay. And then further, I was thinking about the common experience of blaming your parents. Mm-hmm. And then going further from that, because, of course, we don't need to talk about that. We're familiar. Do you believe, Lynn Burnfield, here on Living on Purpose, that we choose our parents for the lessons we need to learn in this lifetime?
Wow. Yeah, personally, I do. Yeah, I do. Of course, I couldn't prove it. But if we're not talking in metaphysical terms, if we're talking in psychological terms,
okay.
While I believe that it is the experience that we have as children with our parents that creates whatever it is we're doing later in life and that that is what we have to contend with, I never think in terms of blame. because for me, those parents are doing what was done to them and what was done to their parents. And we're just handing down either generation by generation or karmic reincarnation by reincarnation, whatever came before. And it's our challenge to tackle that in our own lifetime.
Yeah, and it's good to remember that even though we've only known our parents as our parents, they are having a moment-by-moment experience of making it up as they go along, just as we are. Yeah. And I remember that was a revelation again as well, to realize that we're all doing the best we can with each moment, or not, depending how we're feeling that day. And as parents, they're doing the best they can. And there's no big handbook, there's no big guidebook on how to be a parent. In fact, I think it's a really extremely lacking aspect of education. My guest in the next half hour is a divorce coach. It's like beyond the fairy tale. There's a lot involved in parenting and families and the influence. And while we were talking here, I'm just getting the impression that a lot of my sense of the world and my sense of place in the world is really very intricately linked in to how my parents look at the world and how they feel about themselves and how I incorporated those feelings of them about themselves. It had nothing to do with me.
That's right.
And yet it's an extremely strong effect and influence on my whole consciousness.
It's hardwired.
It's really hardwired.
It's hardwired. The really important thing for me, anyway, is simply to recognize that it is hardwiring, but it can be rewired. I do a lot of work these days on brain chemistry and altering brain chemistry, altering the neuron firing, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So that we're not stuck with what we experienced, you know, the limited experience that we had.
The limited experience.
And that's all anyone can have, mm-hmm. is the limited experience of mm-hmm. whatever went on, you know, when we were born.
Yeah, exactly. Lynn Birdfield, it's so wonderful to have you as a guest on my show. And we could continue. I mean, we're just barely getting warmed up here. But half an hour is all we have, because mm-hmm. you have a client to get home to talk to. Yeah, mm-hmm. with a big smile on your face.
I do.
Yeah, I think you're a blessing to many people.
Thank you, Lynn. Mm-hmm.
So I have a very brief last question for you, which I did warn you about.
Yes, you did.
If you could briefly tell us, and it can be as brief as you want, what living on purpose means to you.
You know, I thought about it, and it's clear to me that for me, for reasons that I don't need to go into, I had to separate all of the things that I can do. You commented at the beginning, I wear a lot of hats, and I do. And I kept them all secret. So people who knew me as the songwriter didn't know I was a therapist, and the people who knew me as a consultant didn't know I wrote songs. And I needed to keep that apart because I was afraid of the response I would get from people. And that now, for me, for the first time in my life, I'm presenting myself as all of the things that I am. And in fact, The Lynn Show is the very first time I've ever done that.
Wow.
And so living on purpose for me really is about not hiding, being transparent as possible.
Oh, well, I'm so touched that you're here sharing that with me on Living on Purpose today, Lynn.
Thank you very much. I don't think I've said that anywhere else. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you heard it here first. Live and in person.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Oh, you're so welcome. And we're just going to go out with the song, out of this half hour with you, with the song You Really Can, which is the last track on mm-hmm. your CD, I Won't Go With a Whimper. And this is what you usually open your show with, I
That's
understand.
Correct.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much again. And do you have a website or some contact?
I do. Mm-hmm. TheLynnShow.com.
Oh, well, that's easy. And that's Lynn with an E.
That's correct. Survive. Finding.
silent hug from no.
And that was Lynn Burnfield from her CD, I Won't Go With a Whimper. And that was, of course, called You Really Can. This is Lynn Thompson, and you're listening to Living on Purpose live from Sarasota, Florida. And this is Friday, April 11th, 2008.